This is Audible.
Echo and Harper Audio present Exciting Times, a novel by Nisha Dolan, performed by Aoife McMahon. Part 1. Julian. Chapter 1. July 2016. My banker friend Julian first took me for lunch in July, the month I arrived in Hong Kong. I'd forgotten which exit of the station we were meeting at, but he called saying he saw me outside Kee Wah Bakery and to wait there. It was humid. Briefcase bearers clopped out of turnstiles like breeding jennets. The tannoy blared out husky Cantonese, Mandarin like a bell, and then a British woman saying, "Please mind the gap." Through the concourse and up the escalators, we talked about how crowded Hong Kong was. Julian said London was calmer, and I said Dublin was too. At the restaurant, he put his phone face down on the table, so I did the same, as if for me, too, this represented a professional sacrifice. Mindful he'd be paying, I asked if he'd like water. But while I was asking, he took the jug and poured.
"Work's busy," he said. "I barely know what the hell I'm doing."
Bankers often said that. The less knowledge they professed, the more they knew, and the higher their salary. I asked where he'd lived before Hong Kong, and he said he'd read history at Oxford. People who'd gone to Oxford would tell you so, even when it wasn't the question. Then, like everyone, he'd gone to the city. "Which city?" I said. Julian assessed whether women made jokes, decided we did, and laughed. I said I didn't know where I'd end up. He asked how old I was. I said I'd just turned 22. And he told me I was a baby and I'd figure it out. We ate our salads and he asked if I'd dated in Hong Kong yet. I said not really, feeling "yet" did contradictory things as an adverb, and there were more judicious choices he could have made. In Ireland, I said, you didn't date. You hooked up, and after a while you came to an understanding. Julian said,
"So you're saying it's like London?"
"I don't know," I said. "I've never been."
"You've never been to London?"
"No."
"Ever?"
"Never," I said, pausing long enough to satisfy him that I'd tried to change this fact about my personal history upon his second query and was very sorry I'd failed.
"Ava," he said. "That's incredible."
"Why?"
"It's such a short flight from Dublin."
I was disappointed in me too. He'd never been to Ireland, but it would have been redundant to tell him it was also a short flight that way. We discussed headlines. He'd read in the FT that the offshore renminbi was down against the dollar. The one piece of news I could offer was that a tropical storm was coming.
"Yes," he said. "Mirinai. And a typhoon the week after."
We agreed it was an exciting time to be alive. Both storms came. Unrelatedly, we kept getting lunch.
"I'm glad we're friends,"
he'd say, and far be it from me to correct a Balliol man. I felt spending time with him would make me smarter, or would at least prepare me to talk about currencies and indices with the serious people I would encounter in the course of adult life. We got on well. I enjoyed his money, and he enjoyed how easily impressed I was by it. Chapter 2. I'd been sad in Dublin, decided it was Dublin's fault, and thought Hong Kong would help. My TEFL school was in a pastel-towered commercial district. They only hired white people, but made sure not to put that in writing. Like shark's teeth, teachers dropped out and were replaced. Most were backpackers who left once they'd saved enough to find themselves in Thailand. I had no idea who I was, but doubted the Thais would know either. Because I lacked warmth, I was mainly assigned grammar classes, where children not liking you was a positive performance indicator. I found this an invigorating respite from how people usually assessed women. Students came for weekly lessons. We taught back to back, besides lunch. I became known as the resident Lady Muck for stealing away between lessons to urinate.
Ava, where were you?
Said Joan, my manager, one holy and apostolic, which there was money in being, though not Catholic, since there wasn't, when I returned from a toilet break. She was one of the first Hong Kongers I'd met. It was 5 minutes, I said.
Where are the minutes coming from? Said Joan. Parents pay for 60 per week.
And what if I end the class slightly early, I said, then start the next one slightly late, 2 minutes from one, two from the other?
But that's two from the start and two from the end of the middle class.
Joan tried to gesticulate, but found it difficult to mime a three-class sandwich as a two-hand person. She abandoned the endeavor with a tart sigh, like this was my fault. I needed to take it to a higher power. Our director, Benny, was 40 and wore a baseball cap on backwards, either to look like he loved working with kids or to stress that he was his own boss and dressed to please no one, not even himself. Hong Kong born, Canadian educated, greasy and parsimonious, he owned a dozen other schools and, evocatively, I felt, an Irish seaweed company. He spoke of this last as back in Connemara, a place neither of us had been, though I supposed that enhanced the poetry of it. The book stopped with him, a reflection of his general distaste for parting with currency. When Benny came at the end of July to pay me, I said I was thinking of leaving.
Why? He said. You've been here a month.
I need to go to the toilet between classes. I'll get a UTI if I don't.
You're not quitting over that.
He was right. Aside from anything else, I hadn't quit over their racist recruitment policy, so it would have been weird to leave just because I couldn't piss whenever I wanted. I knew I'd do anything for money. Throughout college back in Ireland, I'd kept a savings account that I charmingly termed abortion fund. It had €1,500 in it by the end. I knew some women who saved with their friends, and they all helped whoever was unlucky, but I didn't trust anyone. I got the money together by waitressing, then kept adding to it after I had enough for a procedure in England. I liked watching the balance go up. The richer I got, the harder it would be for anyone to force me to do anything. Just before leaving for Hong Kong, I sat my final exams. While they were handing out the papers, I counted how many hours I'd waited tables. Weeks of my life were in that savings account. For as long as I lived in Ireland, and for as long as abortion was illegal there, I'd have to keep my dead time locked up. That evening, I used most of the money to book a flight to Hong Kong and a room for the first month, and started applying for teaching jobs. I left Dublin 3 weeks later. The week I started, they told me the common features of Hong Kong English and said to correct the children when they used them. I go already to mean I went. That was wrong, though I understood it fine after the first few days. La, for emphasis, no la, sorry la, wasn't English. I saw no difference between that and Irish people putting sure in random places. It served a similar function, sure, but that wasn't English either. English was British. Chapter 3. August. Julian wasn't bothered coming out to meet me after work, so I started going straight to his apartment in mid-levels at about 9 p.m. I told him I found this awkward and degrading. Actually, I liked taking the outdoor escalator up. I got on the covered walkway at Queen's Road and went uphill over hawker stalls on Stanley Street. Then signs, game and fun, happy massage, King Taylor, and high-rises and enormous windows on Wellington Street. Then came fishy air wafting up from Central Street Market and the old police station stacked with thick white bricks like pencil erasers. When I reached Julian's building, I got a visitor card from the lobby and went up to the 50th floor. Inside, his apartment looked like a showroom, the sort that had been unconvincingly scattered with items anyone could have owned. His most obviously personal possession was a large grey MacBook Pro. We got takeaway, I did the washing up, and then he'd pour us wine and we'd talk in the sitting room. The mantelpiece was bare besides an empty silver picture frame and cream candles that had never been lit. By the window was a long brown corner sofa. I'd take my shoes off and lie on it with my feet on the armrest, crossing one leg over the other and alternating them during gaps in the conversation. He smoked cheap cigarettes. To encourage himself to quit, he said. We'd first met in the smoking area of a bar in the Lan Kwai Fong, where he'd either noticed me looking at him or started looking at me first until I looked back. He was good at engineering ambiguities. I was bad at avoiding them. He'd said everything very slowly that night, so I'd assumed he was drunk. But he still did it sober, so I gathered he was rich. A month into our acquaintance, he asked,
"Do you meet all your friends in bars?"
"I don't have any friends," I said. He laughed. In some moods, he told me about markets. In others, he'd fire questions at me, only attending to my answers to the extent that they helped him think of follow-up inquiries. I'd said it before, but he wanted to hear it all again. The two brothers, the brown terraced house in one of Dublin's drearier suburbs. That I'd taken a year out after school to save up for college. That after 2008, I shared a room with my brother Tom so we could rent the other one out to a student. That none of this made us poor, and was in fact pretty much what had happened to Ireland as a whole, due in no small part to the actions of banks like his. Julian had gone to Eton and was an only child. These were the two least surprising facts anyone had ever told me about themselves. He wanted to know if my accent was posh where I came from. I'd never met an English person who didn't wonder that. Most wouldn't ask outright, and he didn't. He just asked what kind of Dublin accent I had. But they found some way to convey their curiosity. I told him it was a normal Dublin accent. He asked what that meant. I didn't know enough about British accents to make a comparison.
"Well," he said, "how does a posh Dublin accent sound?"
I tried to do one, and he said it sounded American. He'd ask what I proposed to do with myself when the time came to get a real job. He was almost paternally adamant that I shouldn't waste my degree on lowly employers, and even paid convincing lip service to not thinking less of me for not having gone to Oxford. But when it came to which jobs he did consider good enough for me, he was vague. Law was glorified clerking. Consulting was flying to the middle of nowhere to piss around with PowerPoint. Accountancy was boring and didn't pay well. And banking, in some nebulous way, wouldn't suit me. I liked when he rolled up his shirt sleeves. He had big square wrists and jutting elbows. Sometimes I worried he could tell how often I thought about his arms. He was always calling me a freak for other, much less strange things, so I couldn't own up to it. The first time I stayed in the guest room was in mid-August when the tropical storm Dianmu hit. After that, Julian always offered to put me up when midnight approached. Depending on my energy, I accepted or got the green minibus home. The covered escalator only went one direction at a time, down for the morning rush hour or up for the rest of the day. That was the shape of it, but it didn't have a name, apart from hanging out, catching up, or popping in for a chat, which was, to be fair, the content of what we were doing. He was so stretched for time that I found it semi-plausible he just preferred to meet in his apartment for convenience. I asked whether bankers had time for relationships.
"Usually not at the junior levels," he said. "A lot of them just pay for it."
The way he said "it" made me uneasy, but there wasn't any point in taking things up with banker Julian. He was too self-assured to notice when I criticized him. He registered that I'd said something, then continued a parallel conversation. When he paid for my takeaway, or when he took me to a restaurant, and when in turn I spent time with him, I wondered if he saw himself as paying for a milder "it." I liked the idea, my company being worth money. No one else accorded it that value. We sat in high-ceilinged rooms, and he said the Hang Seng was down, and the Shenzhen composite was up, and the Shanghai composite was flat. It wasn't like normal friendships, where I worried if the other person still liked me. He liked hearing himself think aloud, and I reasoned that I was profiting from it, that you never knew when you'd need facts, so it was best to collect as many as you could. One night in his living room, a few glasses into the bottle. I told him he was attractive. I said it exactly like that. I find you attractive, to avoid seeming earnest.
You're quite attractive, too,
he said. I guess that's why we get along.
Could be.
We'd known each other about 2 months, and in total, I'd spent perhaps 30 hours in his company, little more than a day. But I was in the habit of thinking he was a habit.
Thanks for your time,
he'd say as I left. I wasn't sure if he put it formally to give himself an ironic get-out clause like I did, or if he was just unaware how stiff he sounded. He'd add,
I'll text you.
He seemed to think only a man could initiate a conversation. Worse still, it meant I couldn't send him one first. It would look like I despaired of his getting in contact and was only doing it myself as a last resort. I explained to my 9-year-olds that there were 2 ways to say the f sound. The one at the start of think and the end of tooth was the voiceless dental fricative, and the one at the start of that, these, and those was the voiced dental fricative. As a Dubliner, I'd gone 22 years without knowingly pronouncing either phoneme. If anyone had thought there was something wrong with my English, they'd kept it to themselves. Now I had to practice fricatives, voiced and un, so the kids could copy me. Calvin Jung, a show-off but a useful one, volunteered to try and couldn't do it. Hold your tongue still and breathe, I said. That was what the teacher's guide told me to say, but I tried it myself and produced a sound unlike anything I had ever heard from an English speaker, or indeed from any other vertebrate in the animal kingdom. I decided I'd ask Julian to show me how to do it later. Even before I met Julian, I didn't often see my flatmates. We exchanged little more than hellos and good nights. There were 3 of us. I'd booked the room on Airbnb, planning to be there until I could save up a deposit for something more permanent, but the others lived there long term. Emily was the oldest and the most proactive. At 29, she'd been in Hong Kong a few years. Freya was around my age, and her chief hobby was complaining about her job. She changed into her pajamas the minute she got in the door and had 4 sets of house slippers, bedroom, bathroom, kitchen, other. Emily always had comments when I came in. Could you close the fridge more quietly? Was this particular evening's criticism. Sorry, I said. I failed to see how you could make noise shutting a refrigerator, but Emily had an aesthetic sensibility. Them getting ready woke me up. Spoons clanging on bowls, taps protesting on being asked to produce water. But I couldn't brush my teeth until the bathroom was free. I lay there and ran my tongue over the night's accumulated plaque. We often got cockroaches. I swore I heard them in the dark, though I knew scientifically this couldn't be true. I went without eating rather than face talking to them in the kitchen. They weren't that bad. I just never knew what to say to them. So, staying over with Julian became ever more appealing. Chapter 4. September. After about 2 months, I was spending a few nights a week at his flat. The spare room, mine now, I supposed, had a soft twill houndstooth throw and pictures of London on the wall. One day at work, I printed out an image of Dublin and asked if I could put it in the empty frame in the living room.
If you like,
he said. He told me I was welcome to stay over while he was travelling for work, but I didn't. The temptation to go poking around his bedroom would have been overwhelming. The inside was still a mystery to me, but I imagined everything folded and stored in optimised locations for speedy access. One evening when he was abroad, I came home to the Airbnb and Emily ambushed me before I could get to my room. We haven't seen much of you lately, she said. We can't all be here at once, I said. It's claustrophobic.
Let's go for drinks then.
Sure, I said. When?
Tomorrow.
Julian was back from Singapore then. Sorry, I said. I'm having dinner with a friend.
Is this the friend you stay over with?
I don't have that many friends. Emily began to tidy the ugly couch cushions, as if hoping I'd notice how good she was for not asking me to help. The fabric had a talent for gathering hairs, hers and Freya's mostly, since I was never there, but they blamed me anyway.
You can't drop everything for a guy, she said.
I'm not with him.
Why are you always at his place?
I'd stop listening. If she wanted to complain about me never being there, but offer extensive notes whenever I did make an appearance, then no wonder I preferred Julian. The next evening, I narrated the argument to Julian. Between drags of his cigarette, he nodded and, of course, in all the right places. Have you ever had flatmates? I said.
Yes, of course, at Oxford. And when I was starting out in London. Most of them were fine. One guy was a complete nutter. This was my final year of uni. He was doing his dissertation on some existential quandary. You'd hear him pacing around all night, muttering about it. And he never ate solid food. He put everything in this big fucking blender. Lived on smoothies. I think he got the top first in his year.
So having your own place is better?
Substantially better.
Neither of us pointed out that he didn't really live alone anymore. We finished the wine, and he went to get another bottle. My jeans had a hole on the inseam near the top of my thigh. I picked at it, then jerked my hand away when I heard him returning. I said, "What was your last girlfriend like?" He twirled his glass.
"She was fine. She got sent back to London."
"How long ago was that?"
"A few months."
"Any regrets?"
"No, none at all. I don't tend to look back."
We drank our wine and enjoyed each other's silence. His cushions, I noticed, were beautiful. Pebble corduroy, gold and ivory sateen. I picked one up and hugged it to my chest. "That thing you said before about wanting to be a history teacher," I said. "Were you really just bullshitting me?"
"Completely. I'm glad other people do it. But for my part, I'd rather hang on to the dim prospect of owning a house."
He'd said that thing about teaching history the first time we met, and I hadn't been sure if he was joking. I still wasn't. I said, "What if you could own a house no matter what you did?"
"I've never thought about that, because it's certainly not happening in our lifetimes. Possibly I'd have stayed at Oxford and done more history. But there's no point dwelling on it. I have every respect for people who follow their passions, but I prefer stability."
I wondered if he meant his comment to have point. "It could be worse," I said. "You could have no passions and also no stability."
"To be clear, Ava, we're both dead behind the eyes, but at least I can pay the rent."
"Pretty much."
"We really are the new Belle Epoque."
"Arsehole bankers and deadbeats."
"Not all bankers are arseholes."
"Yeah, just you."
"Just me."
"I like talking to you," I said, quite stupidly, I realized. "It makes me feel solid, like someone can confirm I'm real."
"Good."
"Do you like having me here?"
"Yes,"
he said.
"You're good company. And if I've got this space and I like sharing it with you, there's no reason not to."
"You mean it suits you?"
"Not suits. You're making me sound calculating. I'm saying it makes sense."
He seemed closer to me on the couch than he had a moment ago, although he hadn't moved. "If it stopped making sense, would you stop asking me over?" I said.
"You mean, would I do something that didn't make sense to me?"
I leaned over to refill my glass. Our legs touched.
"Here, let me get it,"
he said, and he hovered close as he poured it. I waited. In his room, he ran the errands, pulled the blinds, dimmed the lights, shoved things off the bed, while I took off my necklace, dropping it slowly on the nightstand so the steel wouldn't rattle against the wood. Aware that he was watching me, I tried not to appear curious about his possessions. My hair got in the way. He caught some of it in his mouth, and then it jammed in my zip at the back, and he said,
"I hope this doesn't end in A&E.
"Really?" I said, "because I hope it does."
You say the weirdest fucking things,
he said. Chapter 5 October. I couldn't bear living in an Airbnb forever, but I still didn't have a 2-month deposit saved. At the start of October, I moved my things to Julian's. I told him I didn't have time to go around viewing places. He said I could stay until I did.
Take the guest room,
he said.
I get calls at night.
We kept having sex. In mid-October, Typhoon Haima came, the last of the season. We were trapped indoors until the Hong Kong Observatory gave the all clear. Julian wore an unavoidably air-quoted casual jumper. He called many things casual and kept them in air quotes. I asked why we'd taken so long to hook up.
I didn't want to impose,
he said. The answer I'd been hoping for was that I made him nervous. I hadn't thought he'd had the power to impose, and was startled that he'd felt he had. His sheets were very white. I once left a blot he called a wine stain, either euphemistically or because he could more readily picture me sipping Merlot than menstruating. His interest in making me come felt sinister at first, which revealed to me my assumption that if he wanted something, it would probably harm me. He liked when I bit him, but you had to pick your moment, and I sometimes thought, there are many things I will never become expert in, and I chose this, which did not suggest to me that mine was an internal monologue one would select if one could. I researched the science of biting, learned it would still hurt him later, and knew exactly how I felt about that information. He enjoyed when I lampooned men who went for sexual flattery. It confirmed his view that he was not one of them, while ensuring their pet phrases still left my mouth. I'd be picky about menus, and he'd say I lacked appetite. Untrue, I'd say, plus facetious gesture. I felt I'd cracked someone too patrician for the "you're so good at sex" spiel. He felt privy to my disdain for men susceptible to the "you're so good at sex" spiel. And empirically, I sat across the table, ran my foot up his leg, and said he was good at sex. Then I asked for water and watched his hands as he poured. I wasn't good at most things, but I was good at men. And Julian was the richest man I'd ever been good at. Joan often made me stay behind to help her write vocabulary lists. In Hong Kong English, helping someone to do something could mean you did it and they did not assist. Joan was fond of this usage. That week, the 12-year-old's list included the word mind. The dictionary gave 4 meanings: to be in charge of or deal with, to be offended or bothered by. The seat of the faculty of reason, Iris Huang, looked between the chairs. An important intellectual, Iris Huang, fixed on a chair. The dictionary would not equip these children for Dublin. Mind yourself, upon leaving a house, was different to mind yourself when using a serrated knife. Don't mind him meant he'd been teasing you, and mind him meant either to take care of him or to take care of yourself around him. And all your minding happened in one mind, hopefully your own. I was forever minding things in Hong Kong, but I couldn't always construe in what sense. Julian liked being busy. He was so busy, I would say. Just one day I would like to be busier than him. I would like for him to suggest a plan and for me to not be free.
I'm not that busy, he said. Why do you want to be busy?
It's a status symbol. It's like I'm so in demand in the skilled economy.
That's not the rich, though. That's people like me.
But you're rich.
I'm not.
You have to stop pretending you don't know you're rich, I said. It's unbecoming. Our wealth disparity was too wide to make me uncomfortable. It was a clownish level of difference that I could regard only with amusement. I also felt it absolved me of any need to probe the gendered implications of letting him pay for everything, which was just as well when I couldn't afford for it to be otherwise. If something cost 1% of his income or 10% of mine, why shouldn't he take care of it? I googled the salary range for junior vice presidents at his bank. €137,000 to €217,000 a year, plus bonus and housing allowance. I tried to take heart from this. That he could have that many zeros and not consider himself wealthy surely showed that material lucre would not make me happy, ergo that I didn't need to find a real job. But if money wouldn't improve my life, I couldn't think of anything likelier to. Staying in his flat was possibly a rupture from the capitalist notion that I was only worth something if I paid my own way economically. Or maybe it made me a bad feminist. I could puzzle it out once the experience had passed. There wasn't much point in dwelling on it until then. What if I decided I didn't like staying with him? I'd have to do something else. And I mightn't like any of the alternatives any better. Mam always said, "That's plenty. If you tweak the heating above 17, that's plenty, Ava. Grocery shopping, if you made to pick up a second punnet of cherries, that's plenty." I hadn't told Mam I was living with Julian. She'd regard him as more than plenty, which meant too much. I rang her one weekend when Julian was abroad. "Any news?" she said, clearing her tone of accusation that I'd only call if there was something to disclose. Mam's genius was that when she avoided implying something, you could hear her doing it. "Not much," I said.
"How's your one?"
Your one, unless otherwise specified, meant Joan. "Grant," I said.
"Your man?"
"Grant." "Benny." The first time I'd told Mam about my employers, she'd said,
"They'll keep you out of divilment."
In subsequent phone calls, she tried to judge how they were doing and whether they needed help.
"Any fellas?"
Mam said. "Afraid not," I said. I tried to make it sound like I was looking. Mam had the vague impression that girls in search of boyfriends went to nightclubs, something she liked to picture me, a young one, doing. I could have told her I didn't go because my boyfriend was 28, but he wasn't my boyfriend, and I'd always hated clubbing.
"We've a hard time keeping up with you," Mam said.
This comment rarely bore particular relation to whatever I just said, but she found it instructive to drop it in. "How's Tom?" I said.
"He's grand. Did I tell ye he's after moving out?"
"Yeah."
"Good lad. Hard working. Most boys his age you'd need to push out."
She didn't want me to agree that it was good her younger son no longer needed her. Equally, she didn't want me confirming that she should feel defunct because he was leaving before he'd finished college. Mam dealt in conversational quicksands where moving would only trap you more. I'd told Julian this, and he'd said he never would have guessed that I came from a line of enigmatic women. I'd said, "Why enigmatic women? Why do you think I'm a female pattern enigma? Maybe the men in my family are enigmatic too." He'd said,
"But you do acknowledge that you're enigmatic."
And I'd said, "Maybe. Or maybe it was just being enigmatic."
"George as well," she added.
Her listening comprehension deferred to maternal optimism. She assumed that since I'd asked about Tom, I wanted to hear about both brothers.
"He's happy with his bonus, did he tell you?"
"He didn't," I said.
"He did."
George was a corporate restructuring consultant. This mostly entailed helping companies make people redundant without having to give them severance pay. He did a robust sideline in finding ways to avoid granting women maternity leave.
"And they think someone on his team will make senior consultant," Mam was saying.
"He's a hard worker, him and Tom, a pair of workhorses." The phrase "workhorses" made me think of workhouses, then of how commodiously situated George would be running one in a Victorian novel. With my college brain on, I knew many more people lost their jobs when banks like Julian's played subprime roulette. But the college brain came with a dial. I turned it up for people I hated and down for people I liked.
"And what about me?" I said. "Am I a workhorse?"
I was trying to be funny, which was an error. You couldn't joke with Mam on a long distance call.
"You're not getting enough sleep," she said.
I liked imagining Julian had a wife back in England. "I am a Jezebel," I'd think.
This wine rack was a wedding gift, and I am using it to store Jack Daniels because I have terrible taste in everything. She is Catholic, in the English recusant aristocrat sense, not the Irish poverty sense, and will never grant him a divorce. And I cannot in any case usurp her as the woman who loved him before life and investment banking strangled him creatively. I asked about the wine rack, and he said it came with the flat. I wish Julian were married. It would make me a powerful person who could ruin his life. It would also provide an acceptable reason he did not want us to get too close. The more plausible reading was that he was single, and that while I could on occasion discharge the rocket science of making him want to fuck me, he did not want to be my boyfriend. That hurt my ego. I wanted other people to care more about me than I did about them. As things really stood, I performed petty tasks in exchange for access to him. He jokingly asked me to organize his bookshelf, and when I actually did, he said I was brilliant. From the conditions of the spines, I judged that he liked Tennyson, also Nabokov, though they might have been second-hand copies, or ones someone else had borrowed. One weekend, I made the mistake of pointing out that he should pack for Seoul, and thereafter, he expected me to remind him whenever he went on a business trip. "You're so lazy," I said. "It'd be easier to do it myself than make you do it."
"Knock yourself out," Julian said,
which wasn't the response I'd been trying to elicit. But I thought it could be fun, like kidding out a Barbie doll for an improbable profession. His clothes all looked the same, and he kept a toothbrush and shaving things in a travel bag. I didn't include condoms, not because I minded his seeing other people, but because I was afraid it would seem passive-aggressive. I wondered when he spoke to his parents. He alluded to conversations with his mum, but I never heard them talking. Eventually, I asked.
"There's a routine," he said. "Every few days, she calls on my lunch break."
"What time is that in England?"
6 a.m, but she's up. She gardens.
"What about your dad?"
"Hadn't I told you? He's here."
"In Hong Kong?"
"He's a history lecturer at HKU. They divorced when I was 10.
This had only emerged 4 months into our acquaintance. I wondered what other information he'd been squirreling away and, God loves a trier, if some of it mightn't be spousal. "How often do you see your dad?" I said.
"A few times a year, when we manage."
"Where does he live?"
3 MTR stops away.
"And you see him a few times a year?"
"Yes, when we manage."
The English were strange. Possibly to make fun of me in some obscure way, Julian remembered my parents' names and used them often.
"Have you spoken to Peggy recently?"
he'd say. Or,
"How's Joe?"
His were called Miles and Florence. I found the comparison illuminating, but he didn't. For Brits, class was like humility. You only had it as long as you denied it. On the escalator down the next morning, I pictured his childhood home in Cambridgeshire. Tall, I thought, and empty. Houses were like their owners. I felt cruel, then decided he'd laugh. This reminded me that nothing I said could hurt him. Although I was not someone Julian would bring to meet Florence, I imagined her having me for dinner, just the two of us. I'd mispronounce Nocky, and she'd avoid saying it all evening so as not to embarrass me. I would meet her eye and think, in this way, I could strip you of every word you know. I'd take them like truffles, and you'd say, "Help yourself," and then I'd take those too, and you'd be speechless. On the journey back up mid-levels that evening, I decided it would be very complimentary indeed if Julian were married and not wearing his ring. If he'd worn one, I probably would have taken it to mean he saw me as ambitious. Whenever Julian was abroad, I went drinking with the other teachers. The first time I was invited, Ollie from Melbourne asked, "TST or LKF?" Then clarified, "Sim Sha Sui, Lan Kwai Fong, the nightlife districts," as though this were, including the preschool curriculum, the most obvious thing he'd explained all day. The bars were unlicensed speakeasies, dark and awkwardly spacious, or else rooftops with lights gleaming beyond. During these outings, I felt I had hitherto woefully misdirected my energies in attempting to cultivate a personality. If you didn't have one, then that left more room for everyone else's.
"Are you seeing someone?" said Bryony from Leeds.
"Maybe," I said, 4 cocktails in.
"Put it another way, are you looking?"
"Maybe." Then Madison from Texas pulled me into a conversation with 2 men. Her preferred swain told her she had tits he'd do coke off. There were, as a rule, 3 sorts of man in TST and LKF. Tech, corporate, rugby wolfpack. Madison's pair placed themselves squarely in tech by saying they felt superior to men who wore suits. I felt you could achieve this distinction more efficiently by not having any job. Madison's also ran, touched my arm. I flinched, and he asked if I liked girls. I wanted to say, "My chief sexual preference is that I don't like you." I went to the bathroom and rang Julian. I said, "Do you do coke?"
"What?"
"I've heard all bankers do coke." I'd read that the art critic John Ruskin had been disgusted by an unspecified aspect of his wife's body on their wedding night, which made me realize I'd always had that exact fear about anyone seeing me naked. Julian said kind things about my appearance, and all I could say was thanks, wishing to be cordial without implying I agreed. I'd feel his arms, wonder A, why I was a cold and ungrateful person, and B, if anyone would ever love me. No, the answers were A, I decided to be, and B, no, and eventually say, "I like your arms." You could go manless entirely, and I saw a great deal of elegance in that approach. But enough people felt otherwise that I thought it best to have one. You had to pretend to feel sad if you'd been single too long. I hated doing that, because there were other things I was actually sad about. As with not having any man, I felt not having any sex was the decorous option. But if you were going to have it, you should have it with someone who retained a degree of objectivity. And I had to have it. Otherwise, I'd never stop thinking. We both preferred me on top, and I wondered if that said anything about our dynamic. I felt all your copulative leanings were meant to reveal something deep about you, and if they didn't, you had an uncompelling mind. He wasn't affectionate in bed, but he let me perch my arms on his chest. "What if I were your age?" I said. He asked what I meant. "Would you still be interested in me if I were the same person but your age?"
"How old do you think I am?"
"I don't know," I said, no more conscious of statistics relating to average age of first marriage than any other individual would be. 30?
28, he said. "I think I could live with your being 28 as well."
I was disappointed, and realized I'd wanted him to be into the fact that I was 22. There was nothing else I had that he didn't. Later, I googled what anyone would google. I saw 29 for the UK, but 31 in Hong Kong, reflected that neither statistic said when, or whether, men of his specific socio-economic bracket and emotional makeup affianced themselves, and with reference to the latter, surmised that he was single and did not want me to be his girlfriend. I cried about this no more than any other person would. Chapter 6. November. In November, we went for brunch on Aberdeen Street with Ralph, pronounced Rafe, who'd gone to Balliol with Julian, now worked at his bank, and had an alleged flotilla of Hibernian great-grandparents. 2, he expanded. 1 great-grandparent on each side, which meant Era owed him a whole grandparent, morally. He'd voted for Brexit to have tighter borders, and was applying for an Irish passport to avoid being stopped at them. Later in the conversation, he called himself a PPEist, who'd been a bit of a union hack. Julian said,
"Rafe, you're 30.
Rafe's girlfriend, Victoria, was good at wearing clothes. She was so beautiful, I couldn't see why she was talking to me. Sometimes her eyes said, "I don't know why either." We talked and talked, mutually baffled as to why such a thing was happening when neither of us thought it should. Rafe watched us and seemed to think, women are good at talking.
You're from Ireland, said Victoria, as though for my information. I've been to Dublin.
Did you see the Book of Kells? I said, hoping she'd say no, since I never had. Of course she had not only seen it, but written an extended essay about it for her degree at St. Andrews. Julian disputed her historiography, and she nodded collaboratively as though they were lifting an awkward piece of furniture together from opposite sides. Periodically she touched her Celine trapeze bag. I thought, it's still there, Victoria. It's not going anywhere. The cow's dead. The following week, we drank 6 bottles of rosé with them in a 20s-style speakeasy. Victoria told me in the bathroom that she was cheating on Rafe with a married hedge fund guy. She said the thing no one told you about affairs was that the administrative challenges were not inconsiderable. Then she asked if I found it weird that Julian claimed we weren't going out when we clearly were. I said I didn't.
It's weird, she said authoritatively. She added, do you fuck?
Which I thought in its own way a remarkable collation of words. She said it with the tone in which one might say, do you vape? Another sentence I would never utter. I replied that I did lots of things.
I'm sure you do, she said. Then, are those your real eyelashes?
The Hong Kong winter had set in. I called it that, the Hong Kong winter, because I'd have to renounce my Irish passport if I started counting 20 degrees Celsius as actual winter. In truth, I'd been gone nearly 5 months and did find it cold. My bank account was growing now, especially from not paying rent. I rarely spent the money. I preferred to think of it as time I could use later. On the street where I worked, I passed tourists eating street food, plodding in and out of scaffolded buildings to haggle in cheap phone shops. The British ones wore shorts, and the wool-coated locals pretended not to see them. There was a small seasonal window where you could dress for winter. It was no one's business spoiling it. Julian said he'd be in Tokyo in December. I wondered why he was telling me. Then he clarified that it wasn't one of his weekend business trips, but 3 weeks. I nodded and asked intelligent questions as I separated the rubbish. We'd had dim sum. I took care to rinse the oil off the packaging. What are you doing there? I said.
Banking. Money.
Whenever I say you work with money, you're like, Ava, I'm not a retail banker. I'm an investment banker.
It's all money, ultimately, Julian said. The degree of abstraction is what separates me from the nice man you talk to about getting a credit card. And the level of risk.
Please, tell me more about how you love black pointy lines and you hate red pointy lines.
Look, if I could explain my job in a sentence, it wouldn't pay so well.
Brain surgeons.
What?
Brain surgeons can explain what they do in a sentence, I said. They fix brains.
I don't know how I'll manage without these observations in Tokyo, he said. Keep a diary.
This exchange had catechized Julian on several points. I told him that A, he had a prestigious and well-recompensed job, B, I didn't, and C, to break the monotony of his status, he liked women with lip. Women other men found waspish, and who found those men feeble, but who were quite at home in his living room, or one of them was, there in archetype and not as someone he specifically cared for, her auteur being something they had in common. The blowjob, too, proved edifying. Men, I could do just fine. As always, I packed for him, throwing in t-shirts in case he'd be required to flaunt his off-duty fashion sense. I showed him the clothes scrunched up like sushi rolls and said I'd earned a new iPhone at least.
For sure, he said. I'll come back with a suitcase of Veblen goods.
I asked what that meant in English and he said, luxury commodities. They were different to normal goods in that the demand actually went up with the price. As he talked, I attended partly to what he was saying and partly to questions, such as why I blew him when he did things like say he'd be away for 3 weeks, which showed he didn't need me. whether I packed for him specifically between blowing him and being bought things, so I wouldn't feel him buying me things was directly because I'd blown him. Whether, conversely, I did things like pack for him because I was worried he wouldn't buy me things just because I'd blown him. And then I'd be forced to confront how little blowing him meant by the only metric he used to show affection. Whether the latter was especially bleak, because that meant packing for him was worth more than blowing him, and I was honestly not that good at packing. And how on earth I emerged from all this convinced I was the powerful one. I said, "So, iPhones are Veblen goods and bread isn't?"
"Exactly. Well, bread's a Giffen good. What will you do while I'm gone? I can look up museums."
"I'm not a child, I can do that myself."
"Just offering."
"Can I come with you?" I said, ironically.
"I'm busy,"
Julian said, ironically.
"It wouldn't be fair on you."
"It's never fair," I thought, sincerely. "If it were fair, then you wouldn't spend so much money on me." The idea came to me fully formed in words before I remembered to be startled by it.
"I know you don't want me to go."
When he said that, I wanted to go to his potentially matrimonial wine rack, choose his jammiest Cabernet Sauvignon, open it tenderly, and empty it over his MacBook. I didn't. He'd buy a new laptop tomorrow, be pleased with the improved touch bar, and deny to my face that I had done that thing with the wine until a point in some future argument where he suddenly needed evidence I was crazy. None of this would address why his comment had upset me.
"Ava, are you all right?"
he said. "I'm fine." I despised him. Not wanting him to go was an emotion produced by me, not him. He'd witnessed me having and failing to smother a feeling and said he'd noticed, and he profited, not me. This showed how public schoolboys coattailed on stolen labor. He receivedly pronunciated his delfactory fricatives, and he took his time doing it, because he could. Because he and his vampire class would live forever off lives leached in their factories, and ultimately everywhere else too, at, smaller words, some degree of abstraction. My wanting to cry was a reflection mainly of my social conscience. He opened the window and lit a cigarette. "Let's talk about something else," I said. Julian concurred.
"Tokyo?"
"Sure. Do you know Japanese?"
"Not a word."
"Konnichiwa," I offered.
"Great. Now I've got one word."
"It's actually two. In Japanese. Konnichi, and then wa."
"Ava, are you all right?"
"I'm fine."
"Listen, I really do like you quite a lot."
"You too," I said, which made no sense. Surely "you too" meant I thought he also liked himself a lot, but he didn't mind. That night I spent longer than usual pretending not to want him in ways that made it obvious I did. It wasn't as much fun as I usually found it, or as satisfying as I knew slicing a machete through a row of his shirts would be. But I enjoyed the clarity of the exercise. There was something Shakespearean about imperious men going down on you. The mighty have fallen. When we'd finished, I borrowed one of his famous casual jumpers, and he told me he liked how my ears stuck out. He said it made me look attentive. I asked, did he mean I looked like I had good hearing, and he said no, not that exactly, but it made me seem alert. "In Victorian times," I said, "women cut off a lock of hair and gave it to men to keep."
"I don't want your hair."
"I'm just describing the practice."
"Right, good description. I still don't want your hair."
"Do you want something else of mine?"
"I've got your texts," he said. "They probably say more about you than your hair. And I want that jumper back."
"I prefer you in a suit," I said. He didn't sympathize enough with my politics to understand how embarrassing or personal a confession this was. Chapter 7. December. When Julian and I said goodbye at the airport, I made myself walk away first. I looked up at the steel beams, felt for my suitcase, then remembered I hadn't brought one because I wasn't the one leaving. In the 2 months I'd been in the flat, my impression had been that he was hardly around. It turned out he'd been home quite a lot, and we often had sex, and I didn't like the sudden withdrawal of these conditions. I didn't want to eat. It felt unnecessary doing it by myself. Alone in the flat, I texted him, but he replied hours later or not at all. I took to calling instead. I felt he could tell from my voice that I was in his bed and wearing his shirt. At the end of his first week away, I asked on the phone about Japan. He said it was cleaner than Hong Kong, adding that he supposed I read more when he was away. In other words, I said, you think I haven't any friends apart from you?
You don't need any.
That sounds like the kind of thing a creepy possessive boyfriend would say.
It's just as well I'm none of those things, isn't it?
I wished then that I'd saved my remark for a face-to-face conversation. He sounded weak and studiedly impartial on the phone, like a doctor giving you a negative prognosis near the end of a shift where they'd already delivered lots of other bad news. You say that a lot, I said. By the way, I'm still not your boyfriend. Like you think I need reminding. I'm not stupid. The statement that I wasn't stupid, which I had intended as neutral information, sounded sharper than expected.
I'm aware you're not stupid.
So why do you keep saying it? I feel like you're hiding something.
I didn't really.
He'd been clear that he liked having me around, but didn't want anything serious. His honesty hurt my pride, so I told myself he was a liar. And I couldn't even feel truly, sumptuously sorry for myself, because it wasn't reciprocation I was craving. My desire was for Julian's feelings to be stronger than mine. No one would sympathize with that. I wanted a power imbalance, and I wanted it to benefit me.
I don't know why you think I lie about everything, he said.
Okay, you're not a liar, I said. Happy?
Euphoric. Could you endorse me for that on LinkedIn?
I'll get one just to add you.
I do see how living in my apartment might feel illicit until we've taken that step.
I got out of bed and stood at the door to the balcony. Why do you buy me things? I said.
Do you mind?
No, but I'm curious.
I mean,
he said,
none of it costs very much.
I decided he'd said that on purpose. It was less upsetting than thinking it was accidental. If I'm such a scrounger, I said, you know you can get rid of me.
Could you rewind to where I called you a scrounger? I seem to have missed it.
It's the impression I get.
I can't be held responsible for every tin hat notion you come up with.
So I'm a crazy, irrational woman?
If you listen more carefully, Ava, you'll notice I think you're extremely sane. I assume there's some purpose behind what you're saying. I'm trying to unearth what it might be.
You can't be extremely sane. You're sane or you're not. Like how you can't be extremely allowed to work in Hong Kong.
As a white British banker, I think it's fair to say I'm extremely allowed to work in Hong Kong.
I laughed. I was always relieved when he said things like that about himself. Like, good, so it mustn't annoy him when I do it. People frequently said things about themselves that they did not like others saying. But I was not always inclined to be good at men. What are we like? I said.
I'm not used to dealing with people like you,
he said. Sometimes I was good at him. Sometimes he was good at me. Sometimes we were good at each other. And sometimes neither of us was any good at anything. The whole thing was so confusing that I wished one of us had all the power, and I didn't even care if it was him. Though that clearly wasn't true, or I'd just let him win. At which point he'd lose interest and replace me with a model because they're thinner, or a dachshund because they shed less. Are you a dog person? I said.
What? No.
Me neither. I like a bit more of a challenge. We laughed at men who found such statements gratifying.
Look, he said, I'd better go. I've a string of meetings tomorrow. But it was good catching up. Talk soon, babe.
I liked that. Babe. It made me feel accounted for. I went with the other teachers to a bar in TST. We ordered drinks and variously reminded people we were seeing someone or advertised that we weren't. Scott from Arkansas did both. I asked why he was claiming to be single when he'd mentioned his girlfriend 3 seconds ago, and he said he'd made her up because I intimidated him. I wondered if he would be a better or worse person without narcotics. In the club down the road, Madison from Texas started dancing with me. We didn't move much, but she touched my hip. I remembered in college when a girl was off her face at Workman's and we shifted, and a man in a polo shirt asked, could he watch? You already are, I'd thought. Men were rarely true voyeurs. They wanted you to know they were there. Madison said she envied me because I did the inscrutable thing without trying. Men liked that, she said. Madison always thought it would excite me to learn what men liked. She stroked my arm when Scott from Arkansas approached. Scott said his flatmate was away. Madison said, that's interesting, Ava, isn't it? There was no limit to what Madison thought would interest me. I asked Scott if he meant his girlfriend was away and whether their arrangement was monogamous, and Madison looked at me like I was a child who'd asked their aunt about her divorce. Narcotics made Scott better, I decided, in that they kept him honest by hampering his ability to lie plausibly. I wondered what Julian told other women about me. Madison tried to kiss me. Her tongue tasted cheap, like something from a can.
You still haven't told me if you like girls, she said.
I said, there's lots of things I don't tell people. Chapter 8.
Mom thinks there's a guy,
said Tom on the phone. Why? I said.
She says a mother knows, and that's how she knows. Circular, but sure look.
He told me about his degree. He was studying philosophy without much gusto, but was getting his essays in and going to lectures and everything. A lecturer had told him he was destined for a mid-2-1, and he wasn't offended like I would have been. Mom kept asking what he'd do after. Listen, I've been meaning to tell you, I found myself saying. Don't tell Mom, but there actually is a guy.
Okay.
It's not serious, but it's been good so far. He's posh, though. Not Dublin posh, British posh. He says, shall.
I'd say you like that,
Tom said. What's that supposed to mean?
Ah, no, Ava.
It was true that Julian conformed with my record. My two ex-boyfriends from home had gone to South Dublin private schools and knew all about rugby. That they had no personal interest in it only made this a clearer mark of status. It was the sort of theory I could form very easily about someone else. Ava is drawn to wealthy partners as a means of quieting her class anxieties. In practice, having sex with rich people only heightens her awareness that she herself is not rich, and yet she keeps on doing it. But it felt robotic to conclude something like that about myself. I couldn't help feeling it had to be more complex than that. And what about you? I asked Tom.
There's no one right now, he said. I'll tell you if there is.
You always say that. Then 3 months later you're like, oh, there was someone, but it's over now.
I don't tell you till I know it's a thing. Then when I do know it's a thing, we break up.
Do you get a say in it?
Sometimes I'm even the one to do it. But I never see it coming. Self-awareness for you.
You've more of it than me, I said.
No, you're too self-aware. You can talk yourself into anything. Then there's no talking you out of it.
Is that why you've not said anything about Julian?
Is Julian the tan?
Don't call him a tan.
He's still a tan.
I agreed this was factual.
Look,
Tom said,
I can't tell you what to do.
I wished he would. My stance amounted to, I am glad Julian does not demand intimacy, and annoyed at him for not offering it. I stay in his apartment for free and complain it's done strange things to our dynamic. I hate needing him and address this not by taking responsibility for my own happiness, but by playing his games, which could equally be my games because I'm unsure who started it. I wanted to tell someone that and have them say either, Ava, you are being unreasonable, or, Ava, we all bear our crosses, but yours has the most nails. Anything but sounds complicated. I'll let you go, I said. Tom had more than one person he actually liked seeing. At work, I imagined nice things that might happen to me if I were a different person. When I realized I'd been daydreaming, I'd start correctively listing things I disliked about myself. The children wrote essay plans, and I thought, flat feet, doughy hands, clumsiness, moral cowardice. When Matthew Yim asked a question, I felt rudely interrupted. The poster opposite said, prepositions of movement. It had frogs in different locations. On the table, under the table. I thought, pale. Hostile to people who have shown me nothing but kindness. Probably bad at sex. In the staff room, the others were talking about adoptive versus biological children. I said, I'd adopt. I wouldn't inflict my gene pool on anyone.
Ah, don't say that about yourself, said Madison from Texas.
To the list I added, sense of humor, not for everyone. 3 weeks into December, the day before Julian's return, I messaged him. Hey, so I want to say sorry for how I've been treating you. I'm really unnecessarily mean to you, and I justify it as socialist praxis when it literally isn't. I don't want to call myself a horrible person, but see, I know I do that so you can't say it. But I like having you in my life. I sent it on the balcony. If I threw my phone over the railings, I'd never see if he replied. The patio in front of the lobby looked like a small mosaic tile from overhead. Ant people played out their personal histories with the same degree of immersion in which I was experiencing mine. Julian replied a few hours later.
Thanks for the message. I know it can't have been easy to write. I'll see you soon.
It could have meant anything, including what it purported to. I surprised him at the airport. The arrivals section was huge, but his height made him easy to spot. At passport control, he had everything ready so as not to waste time. He met my eye from far away. I ran to meet him. Chapter 9. Banking slowed down just before Christmas. I suspected Julian told me that with disapproval. His MD had darkly intimated he'd be pleased with his bonus, which meant top tier or none at all.
Hengeville's a sadistic American cunt, Julian said. So quite possibly the latter.
He made no financial plans that relied on the money, then found himself perplexed what to do with it. I said that must be hard for him. What's American doing in that sentence, by the way? I said. Julian took off his suit jacket and placed first it, then himself on the couch. Like, pray, elaborate. I said, you seem more resentful when your superiors are American. Julian explained there was an important difference. When an American MD wanted something on their desk tomorrow morning, they said they wanted it on their desk tomorrow morning. When a British one did, they said it wasn't urgent, tomorrow morning would do. That evening, I made us try cooking, phrasing it that way. I am making us try cooking, so Julian would see it as a cultural activity, like ceramics classes. He chopped the vegetables and remarked that he'd do it professionally if it paid better than banking. I asked if there was anything he wouldn't do for more money, and he said no, probably not.
I should mention, he said, that I'll have to see my father.
That's fairly common, I said, at Christmas.
It's just that if I have to spend Christmas with Miles, and you want to spend Christmas with me, that means both of us will need to go.
I don't mind, I said. I'd love to meet him.
He'll like you. He hates neoliberalism, though I've never heard him define it.
I laid out the cutlery and wine glasses. After dinner, he read one of his Victorian doorstoppers and